When Refugees Become Family, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Toronto resident Peggy Karas wanted to help sponsor Syrian refugees, but she wasn't sure what to expect.
Once I met them, it was a pleasure to know them and be part of their family, and helping them became a real joy.
Also, the Iraqi doctor now selling car parts in America.
When I look at myself in the mirror, I say, hey, you are a doctor. You have to be a doctor again.
Plus, Shahar Erez enlisted in the Israeli military as a woman, but when Erez became an officer, there was a big announcement.
I realized that in order for me to have an open and honest relationship with my soldiers, I must be first open and honest with them.
The Israeli military's first openly transgender officer, coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you could make it here today. We're going to start in Canada. In the past on the show, we've told you about the program that allows Canadians to sponsor Syrian refugees. The idea is that a group of Canadian citizens works together to welcome and support refugee families for a year. Thousands of Canadians have done this, and in many cases, strong bonds get formed between Syrians and Canadians. Listen to how Noor Yassin, a 20-year-old Syrian who was resettled in Calgary, talks about her sponsors.
Sponsor, I love them from my bottom of my heart. Because, you know, just when you come to Canada, we are so tired and we had many hard times. When I first came, I say, oh my God, how I can live here? It's like big country for me, a different culture, different place. Everybody do what they want here. But the sponsor, I see them, I feel so happy.
If there is a downside, though, it's that the sponsorship arrangement is supposed to last for only 1 year. And for many of those refugee families, the year is up. But some Canadians and the Syrians they've opened their lives to are finding it hard to let go. New York Times correspondent Jody Cantor and her colleague Katrin Einhorn have reported on the program for the past year.
The extraordinary thing is that they signed up to give a year of time and money to families they never met, they knew very little about, had never communicated with. They either gave or raised about a five-figure amount of money, and they signed up to do it just because they were concerned about Syrian refugees. And actually, I was there when some of the sponsors showed up at an airport hotel and met a group of Syrian refugees they would be adopting for a year. And it was really confusing on both sides. For the Syrian refugees, they had no idea that they were going to be sponsored. I stood there as a translator explained, these are everyday Canadian citizens. They have no connection to the Middle East, but they are committed to helping you for a year. They're going to take responsibility for you. They've found you a home. They're going to get your children educated. They're going to take care of your medical appointments. And by the way, you don't need to pay them back. And the refugees were confused, astonished.
They didn't understand what sponsorship was?
Imagine if you had been a refugee and you had been barely hanging on in a place like Lebanon or Jordan, and there had been tremendous discrimination and anger towards refugees there, and you knew that pretty much none of the world wanted you, and then you show up and you meet these nice people who say that they're going to do everything they can to help you for a year, including giving their own money and time. The refugees were understandably incredulous, and a lot of them thought there must be some sort of ulterior motive. They figured the sponsors were missionaries or something.
Wow. So how about the Canadian sponsors? How did they understand the relationship? Like, did they know that some of these people were basically farmers from these really rural areas?
A lot of them were drawn to help families with kids. What really sparked this in Canada was the famous, or maybe I should say infamous, picture of the little drowned Syrian toddler on the beach in Turkey,
Alan Kurdi. I can't forget his name.
Exactly. And now the reaction in Canada was somewhat different than it was in the U.S. People saw that photo and said, how can we not help kids like this? Alan Kurdi had a very tenuous connection to Canada. He had an aunt in the country, but that was enough to cause a kind of national wave of recrimination and responsibility that, first of all, helped elect Justin Trudeau in the first place because his platform was more refugee-friendly than the Conservative parties. And then second of all, cause all of these Canadians to sign up and volunteer. The point at which we started doing the story, was a point of almost frenzy in Toronto. Kids were going to their parents and saying, everybody else at my school is sponsoring a Syrian family. Why can't we do it too?
Wow. Keeping up with the Joneses in a very humanitarian way. Jody Cantor with the New York Times. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Let's hear now from a Canadian sponsor. Peggy Kairos is a retired geography teacher in Toronto. She got together with friends to sponsor a Syrian family, Mohammed and Wissam Al-Haj, and their four children, which was great for Peggy because she always wanted to have grandchildren, but there were challenges too. None of the children had gone to school, and the Syrian family was not literate in Arabic or English. So improvisation was key during some important conversations.
Well, I suppose one of the most critical conversations was when I arrived to take Wissam to what I thought was a regular appointment at the hospital because we were following her pregnancy. And her husband was making sign language at me and letting me know something about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't get it. So I picked up Wissam, I took her with me, and we picked up a translator on the way to the hospital, at which point she told the translator she was in active labor.
Wow.
None of that had been conveyed to me until that moment. And then I'm like, oh, my goodness, how quickly can I get to this hospital?
So that's an important moment, a kind of a life yeah. moment. What are the sponsors, like, what are you actually doing for these families?
We've enrolled the children in various programs like skating, swimming, after-school programs and soccer and things like that. We've got sponsors going in every morning for 3 mornings a week, tutoring the mother. We have sponsors going in 5 nights a week, 2 at a time, sometimes 3 at a time, to tutor the children and help them with their homework. I'm continuing to take Wissam to medical appointments where necessary. One of our other key sponsors, Liz, is doing a lot of the paperwork, taking them back and forth to the bank, helping them get used to the fact that their rent is now coming out of their account, making sure that it is actually coming out of their account, that the hydro bill is coming out of their account. Quite honestly, all of us are sort of like dropping in, having tea with them, enjoying the time with them.
Does it help you're providing to these Syrians anger any Canadians who might themselves still be striving for that middle-class existence or a more comfortable life?
Of course, we have a huge problem with our Indigenous Native population. You know, we need to help them and totally agree and totally want to do whatever I can there. I also hear from immigrant children and immigrant families, well, nobody helped us because they came as regular immigrants and they had to find their own way. But in many instances, the immigrants, when they arrived, they came to family members who helped them too. And these are people who didn't choose to come to Canada really. They've been forced out of their own country and they're looking for a safe place to go. And Canada offered that.
I guess there's some negotiating those little things of everyday life, like introducing a Syrian farmer family to an ATM. Like, how hard
Absolutely.
Has that been?
That's been fairly difficult because he's not literate. He's never had to deal with a bank machine or a bank even. My friend Liz, who's been in charge of this, she actually made copies of the bank screen on the ATM step by step by step to show him what screen is coming up and what to do next, etc. But I had taken him to the bank earlier in the summer and he was having trouble and I was waiting and waiting in the car. And finally, he came out and asked me to come back in. He couldn't get his card back. He didn't know what to do.
Peggy, what occurs to you when you look to us here in the U.S. and you see the more negative tone this country is taking toward people fleeing war?
I don't believe most Americans really feel that way. When the second story in our series came out in October, 2 American citizens sent us each $35,000 Canadian, plus wow. other Americans sent us donations to help support the Wissam and Mohammed each have a brother they want to bring to Canada. So I think if you gave Americans the same opportunity, there are probably thousands, if not millions, of Americans who'd do the same thing.
Peggy Kairos is a former geography teacher in Toronto who has sponsored a family of Syrian refugees for the past year. Peggy, thank you very much, and thanks for what you're doing for the Al-Hajis.
Thank you, and I just hope this reaches out to other Americans who get behind the idea of sponsorship.
When they flee their countries, refugees and other immigrants have to leave many of their possessions behind. They also often leave their professions behind. Red tape and other barriers can make it tough for people like doctors, nurses, and engineers to work in their field in a new country. But in Seattle, several organizations are trying to help immigrants, healthcare workers in particular, get back to working their jobs. Anna Boyko-Wyrock has more.
Ali Muffridge says he wants to be proud of himself again.
Every time when I look at myself in the mirror, I say, hey, you are a doctor. You have to be a doctor again.
Muffridge is from Iraq. In Baghdad, he says he administered anesthesia for thousands of surgeries, for C-sections, bullet wounds. Muffridge remembers the look on his patients' faces.
I was seeing the the blessing sensation in my patients' eyes when they are starting to pray for me, because I took all the pain immediately from them.
But now, his work has nothing to do with medicine.
My main source of income is an online store. I'm selling car parts online.
He calls it survival work. And it's not unusual for immigrants like Muffridge to see previous professions slip away. The numbers show this, too. While about one-third of foreign-born people in the U.S. hold a college degree, they're less likely than U.S.-born professionals to work in their field. So that's why Muffridge is getting help here, at a welcome back program at Highline College, south of Seattle. It helps immigrants who once worked in healthcare push through red tape and prep for exams to work in the field again.
So we'll begin with pharmacology.
On a recent evening, a group of immigrants study for the National Nursing Certification Exam. They're from all over: Ethiopia, Kazakhstan, Nepal, the Philippines.
Respirations 26, temperature 99 degrees Fahrenheit.
Helping immigrants get back to their careers is important, says Liz Patterson. She leads a similar program at Edmonds Community College near Seattle. Hospitals are serving more people from different cultures, speaking different languages. Healthcare workers from elsewhere help the system, she says.
When you think about when people are sick, when they're hurt, they're scared. If we can at least make them comfortable that people understand where they're coming from a cultural perspective or from a language perspective, it improves the overall quality of healthcare.
But first, foreign-trained healthcare workers must navigate a lot to return to their previous jobs.
Depending on the country that they come from, depending on the experience they have, depending on what they want to do, it can be a long process. It can be quite an expensive process.
From $1,000 for nurses to tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars for doctors and dentists starting over. Patterson says even obtaining old school transcripts can be a major hurdle. No one knows that better than Ali Muffridge, the doctor from Iraq. He tried to get his transcripts from Baghdad, even flew back for them. Still, the country's bureaucracy is getting in the way.
I think I will get some way around it. I'm not sure how, but I'm still thinking.
Even when he does get his transcripts, he must graduate from medical school in the U.S. and pass licensing exams in order to apply for medical residency. Not too long ago, Samir Tsagai was in a similar situation. He was a nurse in Eritrea. He helped deliver babies and loved it.
I like serving people with my profession.
But to help deliver babies here, he must pass both an English and nursing exam and get licensed. Sagai is working on it, carrying thick textbooks and his laptop to a library to study. In between, Sagai works night shifts at a nursing home, dispensing medicine to the residents. He can't wait to take on more responsibility.
I'm excited to start my new career here in the United States as a nurse.
And the other night, he announced just that. He passed the exam. He'd become a registered nurse.
I am done. I did.
Applause from other immigrants like him, hoping to get back to their previous careers. Tsagai encourages them to keep going.
I did it, and then I know that you can do it.
But Ali Muffridge, the Iraqi doctor, he knows it'll be years before he can celebrate.
It's a 12-year project.
What do you think about that?
I'm going to do it. It's nothing personal. This is the law. This is the process. And I have to follow it.
A long to-do list, checking off one box at a time. For The World, Anna Boyko-Wyrock, Seattle.
Coming up, Israel's first openly transgender military officer, just ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Before leaving office, Barack Obama presided over a big change in military policy. That was last June when the Pentagon lifted its ban on transgender service members. The move came 5 years after the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the Clinton-era policy that prevented gay and lesbian troops from serving openly. Israel was way ahead of the U.S. on this. Gay and lesbian soldiers have served openly in the Israeli Defense Forces since 1993. Shahar Erez is a lieutenant in the Israeli military. He's also the first openly transgender officer to serve in the IDF. Lieutenant Erez, who's 23 now, first entered the Israeli military as a female conscript, but he says he was already out as transgender to his family.
Back home, I already identified as a male, but enlisted as a female because I was afraid it would affect my service and I didn't want it. During officer course, I realized that in order for me to have an open and honest relationship with my soldiers, I must be first open and honest with them. And so after a lot of thinking and encouragement from my commanders, I stood up in front of my whole company and just told them my personal story. I was so nervous, actually. I don't remember anything from this talk.
How old were you when you did that?
20.
Wow. You were in charge of 70 soldiers, something like that, right?
Yes.
So what was the reaction? First of all, did they know, did they have any kind of anticipation of what you were about to tell them?
No, actually, not so much. Actually, when I told them my story, I said to them in the beginning that I'm telling this story not in order for them to better know me, but to be a better commander, like to give them another tool to be the best officer they can be.
Have you had sexual reassignment surgery?
I did my upper surgery, my chest surgery, actually during my service. The IDF allowed me to do it, actually, and even pay for it.
I was going to ask, because Israel has universal health care. Does that apply to the defense forces as
well?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, the IDF is my insurance, and so he covered all the expenses for my, also my hormones and my surgeries.
So having already come out to your family, you were kind of primed for this moment. What's it been like since you kind of came out as transgender to the soldiers and to the rest of the defense forces that you work with?
In the beginning, everything was normal, if you can call it.
When you say normal, just kind of nobody was pushing back, no complications, nothing.
Yeah, they just treated me like any other soldier. You know, everybody joined the IDF. Mm. And so we have like a very progressive policy about inclusion and about diversity. And so people are pretty used to meet persons that are different from them. So in the beginning, everything was pretty normal until one day. A friend of mine from officer course contacted me, and she told me some reporter contacted her in order to interview me and write a piece on my story. I agreed, and a few days later when I read the article, I was displeased.
Why? What did the article say? What was the tone it took?
You know, a lot of misgendering and not that accurate, and I was pretty embarrassed to read it, and I decided that I will never do any interviews again. Mm. But then a few weeks later, she contacted me again and told me that some kid contacted the reporter to contact them, to contact me, because he's also trans and want to have a successful service. And of course, I spoke to him, but after him came another one and another one and another one. And I realized there is something bigger than me going on.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, I became a lot more involved in trans service and actually contacted the gender affair office in the IDF. Yes, we have gender affair office.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And we started actually working together to better integrate trans people in the military.
So when you kind of step back and look at the history of LGBT people serving in the military in Israel, have you seen progress over time?
Definitely. Definitely. The IDF allowed LGBT people to serve from the beginning, but early on, we had some sort of policies about where can LGBT serve and where not. But I think more than 20 years ago, we already allowed gay, lesbian, and bisexual serve openly everywhere. Trans service is something that nobody addressed to until recently. You definitely see progress. And, you know, the most important thing for me is to see that the IDF is actively trying to better himself. Mm. Like, this is the most wonderful part when I look at it.
So the IDF has this Office for Gender Affairs. They've supported you. They even have a profile and interview of you on their website. I'm wondering, though, if you ever worried that their kind of public image that they're pushing of you is maybe being used to kind of brush over other IDF controversies like the treatment of Palestinians.
Personally, no. I mean, I don't feel like this. I think that, you know, one of our main goals in the Gender Affairs Office is to spread the word. You know, for kids who need to join the IDF, they need to know they have a place to go to. Like, they will get the right kind of treatment. So those interviews, for me and for them, is the way to spread our policy and make it accessible to everybody. When you get to know the issue, you realize that there isn't any issues around it. Like, for me, for example, you know, taking testosterone is better me as a soldier. I'm kidding, but, you know, I'm stronger. So it really was a non-issue for us.
And right.
I don't think it should be.
Was that something you kind of anticipated, the taking of hormones would make you stronger and maybe a better soldier?
Definitely. You like, I was excited to take hormones. It's like, and growing my beard.
Yeah. I was really struck by the story you told about the article that you were displeased with, and then all of the trans kids who wanted kind of to be in contact. As you've been going to schools and talking to people around the U.S., do you find a similar kind of moment where kids come to you after you've spoken to them and want more information?
Actually, yes. I've been to a high school yesterday, and after I finished talking, some kids came to me, and actually one of them said that she's considering going into the U.S. military. And hearing me give her confidence, it was amazing. Worth everything, I guess.
So the U.S. military finally lifted its ban on transgender people serving in July of last year, 2016. What other countries around the world are still have a prohibition on transgender people that you would like to see kind of really move this along?
There is a lot of countries in the West world that are accepting trans people. Each country, it's a little bit different, but I think the most important part right now is to better integrate trans soldiers inside units and educating the units about trans service.
Shahar Erez is a lieutenant in the Israeli military, the first openly transgender officer to serve in the IDF. Thank you for coming in. Great to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I also recorded a short video interview with Lieutenant Erez. He tells me more about that moment when he stood up in front of the 60 soldiers he was commanding and came out as a man. You can see the video on our Facebook page. Just look for PRI, The World. And coming up on the show tomorrow, a first world problem for U.S. farmers.
Let's just say it's crop planting time and you're out in a field planting corn, for instance. And if the tractor breaks down, and it can be something as small as a sensor in the seat that will shut it down at times, I can't keep planting.
American farmers are unhappy with their high-tech tractors. When one breaks down, the dealer has to fix it using company-owned software.
We're either going to have to go back to older type equipment or find a way to hijack it, probably illegally, and neither one of them things a guy really wants to do.
Why some farmers are hacking into their own tractors with software from Eastern Europe. That's coming up tomorrow. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, Ciervas, Peruvian rockers with certain habits, as in the habits nuns wear. But don't let the outfits fool you.
I think we're a rock band. We want to be a rock band. But is it a problem if a rock band has a Christian message?
Sister Monica and the rest of her band are in the U.S. right now. Their story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Mosul and Aleppo, two cities, one in Iraq, the other in Syria, that have both been devastated by war recently. And in both, civilians have suffered greatly. The battle for Mosul is going on right now, with the Iraqi army pushing hard to kick ISIS out of the city. The Iraqis have the support of a U.S.-led coalition, which includes airstrikes on ISIS-controlled areas. Last Friday, one such strike reportedly killed some 200 civilians in Mosul, and the Pentagon is investigating whether it was a U.S. airstrike. That incident and the general situation in Mosul are being reported in the Western press. But let's face it, that coverage pales in comparison with what we were hearing during the siege of Aleppo in Syria.
The children of East Aleppo are too young to remember life before this. Life before the planes dropping bombs on their homes, hospitals, schools.
That clip from a CNN story last fall is typical of the coverage, which focused a lot on the civilian casualties. In Aleppo, all the players were different. It was Russian bombs falling on opposition rebel areas in support of the Syrian army. Western news coverage of that was extensive, and a lot of it critical of Russia. My next guest says that when you compare coverage of the siege in Aleppo, which is now over, to coverage of the battle in Mosul, what you see is a double standard. Patrick Coburn wrote about this for The Independent in Britain. I asked him first to describe the similarities he sees between the fighting in Mosul and in Aleppo.
The similarity between Mosul and East Aleppo is that both cities are being heavily bombed from the air. In the case of East Aleppo, the Syrian government and the Russians were largely blamed. In the case of Mosul, the blame has been primarily on ISIS holding human shields. So there's very different coverage.
So your point is that if Western media were kind of pointing the fingers at the Russians for what was going on in Aleppo, then the Western media should be pointing the fingers at the American-led coalition for what's going on in Mosul?
Yeah, I mean, the results of bombing a city with a lot of people in it are usually the same wherever they are, whether those cities were in Germany during World War II or whether they're in Syria or in Iraq. Now, there are differences. In East Aleppo, most of the enclave was being destroyed. In Mosul, they say it's slightly more targeted. But even so, and I've been there recently, there's massive destruction.
No, I understand all that, but what do you think accounts for the difference in the coverage?
Well, I think it's very simple. In Syria, they were sort of rather considered our guys, and that the Syrian army and Assad and the Russians were thoroughly demonized. In Mosul, it's the opposite. The Iraqi army is on our side. It's the U.S.-led coalition.
I mean, isn't there a risk, though, with that argument that we start to establish a kind of a moral equivalency between the Russians propping up Assad in Syria and the U.S. in Mosul? I mean, keeping Assad in power, this is a man who's maintained a state of war that's led to the deaths of over 100,000 people.
Yeah, what is equivalent is what actually happens on the ground. If you're sitting in a cellar in East Aleppo, or you're sitting in a cellar in Mosul, and planes are dropping bombs on you, what is the equivalent is that lots of civilians, men, women, and children get killed. And there's, I think, a continual attempt to get away from that, to pretend that somehow our bombing is cleaner than theirs. But in fact, the end result is pretty similar.
That was Patrick Coburn, a reporter and commentator for The Independent in Britain. He was speaking to us via Skype from Erbil in northern Iraq. Let's hear now from Seth Frantzman. He's a reporter for The Jerusalem Post. I asked him if he agrees with Coburn's view that the Western media are, for the most part, ignoring the U.S.-led airstrikes in Mosul.
No, I don't think the Western media is ignoring Mosul. I mean, almost every major media in the West has been highlighting the fact that there were hundreds of people killed recently in Mosul, and that recently the campaign has basically killed a higher number of civilians than it had basically last year.
I mean, there was that one airstrike last Friday that got a lot of attention. But overall, don't you think that Aleppo got a lot more attention than Mosul, even though it has a lot fewer people?
Aleppo deserved a lot more attention because I think we're talking about millions of people. I think we're talking about a destruction of half of the city. I think we're talking about a long siege that took place, a six-year war in Syria in which 12 million people were displaced.
Well, I don't want to get into a debate over which is the more consequential battle. I mean, both have deep and disturbing histories. But aren't both the U.S. and Russia showing a disregard for human life?
I don't think the U.S. is showing a disregard for human life. I think the U.S. has ample, relatively transparent and systematic, I think monthly or every few months, reports on how many civilians they think they've killed. And that's why, for instance, you can go on the website of CENTCOM or the Combined Joint Task Force, and you can read their assessment of what they think, how many people they killed last year. And you can read, for instance, their discussion, an open discussion about their role in probably killing up to 100 or so civilians in Mosul. And they've promised an investigation. And these are all things that I don't think you really see from not only the Assad regime, but I would say in general from Russia. I just don't think you see Russia ever talking about doing an investigation, or actually, do we even see any examples of Russia even taking responsibility for killing civilians? I don't even see that being a discussion that happens in the Russian media or something that the Russian government itself discusses.
Yeah, as to what happened last week with the media, it was pretty striking with the coverage of the airstrike in Mosul that led to 200 casualties in Iraq. And the same week, what happened in London with the terrorist attack near Westminster, in which four people died. And ultimately, that got a lot more attention.
It definitely got a lot more attention in British media or Western media. I don't know if it got as much attention, I mean, in China. I suppose it did. I mean, the West tends to obsess over three or four casualties in a place like England or France, and the media, a lot of the Western media, tends to basically ignore the fact that in Somalia or in Bangladesh or in Burma or in Nigeria, hundreds of people are being killed every week. I agree.
Why do you think the Western media tends to apply different values to different nationalities?
The general nature of human beings and media, I suppose, is that they start with asking, okay, is this casualty like us?
So do you think Western media is now applying kind of these different values to human life in Syria and Iraq, distinguishing between those two? Because, I mean, they were outraged about Aleppo, but now we're hearing less about Mosul.
I think people are outraged about the civilian suffering in Mosul, but let's admit who really caused civilian suffering in Mosul, which is ISIS, Daesh.
Seth Frantzman of the Jerusalem Post, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Another city that's been devastated by war is Homs. It was once a rebel stronghold known as the capital of Syria's revolution, but a long government siege of Homs has changed that. Now the fighting has subsided. My BBC colleague Lise Doucette was there 3 years ago to report on the heavy toll the fighting was taking on the city's civilian population. This week, Lise went back.
I've come to the ancient quarter of the city of Homs to meet a girl, Baraha, who I met here in 2014. She was only 9 at the time, fleeing for her life with her family, 3 sisters, a father, fleeing the fighting around their home in these very streets. And what a girl I met then, traumatized, frightened, a girl who had not just lost her mother in the fighting, but saw a mother killed in front of her eyes when a mortar hit their kitchen. I want to see what Baraha is like now, and I'm just going to her school.
What's the meaning? Book fair.
It's remarkable to see Baraha here in what should be the most normal of settings, a classroom full of children catching up after losing out so much in this war. But she's sitting there, pink headscarf and a big pink plastic watch, and like all of these children, really, really happy to be back in the classroom.
Bedroom.
Your bedroom, Gurfa, yes.
I sleep here.
Oh, very nice. And you have your clothes here, and this is for your hair?
Yeah. I met you 3 years ago, and now you're almost 12. So how has Baraha changed?
I'm much better now. I'm happier. Living in my house again is much better. When we were in the shelter, we had many problems there. People were shouting. When we wanted to sleep, the people started shouting. I'm much, much happier.
You're okay? You're sleeping at night? You don't have bad memories?
I don't remember any of the bad thing. When I go to bed at night, I remember school, I remember the play that I played, and I remember those good stuff. I don't remember the bad things.
How Baraha has changed. But Homs's old city isn't the same either. Just listen to how quiet it is. You can hear the bird song. So many people have fled. The punishing government siege is over. Little Baraha had told me then they'd been reduced to eating cats. This rebel-held area is now back in government hands. But the war isn't over. And for children on all sides, their future is as uncertain as Syria's.
The BBC's Lise Doucette there, reporting from the Syrian city of Homs. When I have a problem with my cell phone, I get my 16-year-old to fix it. So as intelligence agencies around the world are scrambling to boost their country's cybersecurity abilities, it's understandable that to do that, some countries are investing in children. The National Security Agency here in the U.S. sponsors free summer camps to teach coding and cyber skills to elementary and high school students. The U.K. recently announced a new curriculum to teach cyber skills to kids age 14 through 18. But it's Israel that has long tapped into kids' tech skills. Daniel Estrin reports on how the country starts young to build up its cybersecurity prowess.
The Israeli army did not allow me to take photos showing the faces of the 10th graders hunched over laptops in this classroom. Because when they graduate, about half of them will be recruited to the Israeli army's cyber units, including one of its secretive intelligence units, Unit 8200. The equivalent of the NSA in the U.S. One of the kids here is 16-year-old Shalev Goodman. He's got a bandana on his forehead and a hoodie over his head.
I'm not the most athletic person. I do want to give something to the country, so cyber is a good thing to do.
Right now, the kids are just at the beginning of their training. Most are boys, but some are girls. Their instructor, Ben Weiss, has given them an exercise.
There's a network of computers that was hijacked.
And they have 45 minutes to try to...
regain the password, the username, yeah, and find the location of the bad guy who hijacked the network.
The bad guy in the scenario is a character from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh, wow, so serious.
This is the Mug Shimim program. It roughly translates to the accomplished. It's an after-school program for gifted high schoolers from underprivileged parts of the country. And it teaches kids computer programming, coding, encryption, and how to defend a computer network against hacking. Most of these kids will enlist in the Israeli military, like the majority of Israeli 18-year-olds. If they get accepted to Army intelligence, the cyber skills they gain in the Army will help them land a job one day in Israel's powerful cybersecurity industry. Ophir Ben-Yair, one of the program directors, visits schools to recruit kids for the program. He's especially trying to recruit more girls to learn cyber skills.
I think that my best line is to tell them that there is an opportunity here to study something that not many teenagers worldwide have the chance to have, an opportunity that if you don't even try to seize, you might miss something that can change your life.
Some fourth grade classrooms in Israel are teaching computer programming. There are even two new kindergartens focused on computers and robotics. And recently, Israel announced a new national cyber education center to train educators and develop more programs. The guy who will head that national center is Sagi Bar, the same man who runs the high school program I visited. So I asked him a question.
Have you heard of Ender's Game? Did you read it?
Of course. The novel? One of my favorites.
So you know why I bring that up?
Very good question.
Orson Scott Card's sci-fi novel Ender's Game is about children recruited at a very young age to play simulation games, training to fight an alien species. The Israeli director says this is not about conditioning young children for battle. It's about teaching people coding and computer skills that everyone can benefit from, not just future Israeli intelligence soldiers. For The World, Daniel Estrin, Israel.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Rockers are rebels, and these women from Peru that we're about to hear, they might not think of themselves as rebels, but they are. This is Siervas, and here's the deal. Siervas is a group of nuns. Yes, and as you can hear, they rock, they roll, they're on mic, and they also play all the instruments. For the next few days, Siervas will be in Chicago. They're in the Windy City to attend a religious retreat and to give a few concerts. Sister Monica joins me from WBEZ in Chicago. Hello, nice to meet you.
Hi, Marco. Nice to meet you, too.
So I want to ask you about your Chicago visit, because I gather it was somewhat affected by devastating floods back home in Peru. Your convent was damaged?
Well, the road going towards our house, just the river took it away. literally. So we had to, yeah, move away from our house just before we became isolated. So yes, we actually had to move the instruments over the water running around us. We had a concert just the day before we were leaving for Chicago. So it was quite a scene.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, for a group of musicians, performers who write songs that address concern for the environment, what goes through your minds when you see these mudslides and people suffering from the weather?
Oh, it's been a very difficult situation. It still is. We have our heart is divided because we had to leave our house and just the next day come take a plane to Chicago for this trip, which we had planned for a long time before. And it is a very difficult situation in Peru. Many, many people are suffering. We ourselves, we work with the needy, so we're trying to do our best to help people. And as much as the government has been preparing itself to address these problems, it's a much bigger problem that they can handle. It's just too much. It's really something no one had in mind.
Yeah. And so you have your own messages about it, and yet these messages are with a rock and roll soundtrack, which I imagine for many of our listeners is going to be kind of hard to get their head around. But you sisters, you really rock. Did your appreciation of rock and roll start before or after you became a nun?
Well, I entered the convent when I was 25 years old. So I had a life before being a nun. So I did love rock music before, of course.
And the peace and quiet I think of at a convent, does that clash at all with the kind of, you know, you got to turn the amp up to 11 usually with rock and roll and make noise?
I don't think so. I think there's a misconception about religious life. Everyone thinks religious life is about being quiet and silence. And that's not how it is. We are an active nuns. We do a lot of social work. We work with the needy. We work with the poor. Most of the sisters in the band, we go every week to visit women in jail. We go to shanty towns. And religious life is very lively. It's very fun. It's very musical. It's been just part of our life experience to express ourselves through music. So we're not changing anything. We're showing the world what we live every day inside the convent.
What have you found to be kind of the advantages of being a nun that rocks out? Can you reach audiences that, like, you know, regular rock bands can't?
We make our music to show who we are, and because we want to give a message, and we are thinking all the time about the people who will listen to us. Our music, of course, is very quickly to be caught by Christians, by Catholics. But we are very, very happy to see that our music is being heard by many people who are not believers. Our first video clip was made about a song which is maybe the most popular, which is called Confía en Dios, which is Trust in God. And it's amazing for us to see all the comments, people saying, oh, I don't believe in God, but I love the message. I don't believe, I'm an atheist, but I love your music and I love this song. So yes, we are very happy to know that we are reaching audiences besides the one you would expect from a non-ban. Cuando el futuro veas incierto y el temor debilite tu confianza, recuerda que Dios está presente, que nada escapa su mirada. I'm curious to know what you think, whether you're a Christian band or a rock and roll band, because there is actually a genre of music in this country, Christian contemporary music. I don't know, it doesn't feel like you're exactly that. What are you? I think we're a rock band. We want to be a rock band, but is it a problem if a rock band has a Christian message?
You know, know, the world outside the church these days seems more divided than ever, and countries are turning inward. What is your assessment of what's happening in the world today, politically speaking, and what is your message musically with Siervas for dealing with that?
We have a message of hope, a message of faith. We have a message of loving each other. For example, we have a song that talks about people who want to be more than good, because we understand it's not enough to not be bad. You know, people say, oh, I'm not bad, I'm good. But it's not about that. It's about trying to make a difference in the world. And that's the message we have. Of course, it starts with our Christian belief, but that's a message for everyone. We need to make a change. We need to make a difference. And we have to take responsibility about it. Everyone. If everyone started living how they would want others to act towards them, the world would be very different. So we want to give that message.
Sister Monica is a member of a band of rocking nuns from Peru called Siervas. Great to meet you. Thank you so much.
Great to meet you too, Marco. Thank you.
Religious rock, even an atheist can appreciate. What a great way to end the show. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Meet you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.